legacies of these historical injustices, and in our case, genocide, you know, continue to this day. Our sacred sites continue to be desecrated from development.
Indigenous voices are still fighting to be heard after over five centuries of colonization and erasure.
Stated by Dwayne Brewer, who was one of the leaders of the goon squads on the reservation. So, I mean, they're the ones that should be investigated.
We'll hear from political prisoner Leonard Peltier, who is still to see justice in his case.
Anything that comes to reveal the truth of what the nation has done, what it has done to the native peoples, what it has done in Haiti and Cuba and the Philippines, what it has done in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, anything that actually reveals that America is not the shining city on the hill.
This and other reflections on democracy. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliate stations all across the U.S. I'm your host, Jacqueline Bettis. Leonard Peltier is the Native American activist and a member of the American Indian Movement who was convicted of aiding in the killing of two FBI agents during a shootout on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in 1975. Sentenced to prison in 1977, Peltier is now 76 years old.
Loan me a minute, let me borrow your ear. I'll sing you a song about Leonard Peltier. He's gone so long in a federal jail, the innocent victim of a tangled tale.
Leonard Peltier, one of the nation's most well-known and longest incarcerated prisoners, speaks out from the U.S. Penitentiary at Coleman, Florida, at a press conference in 2012.
They confirmed the conviction on most critical evidence against me, the murder weapon. And then we filed a Freedom of Information Act and found two documents where they had done scientific tests from their firearms laboratory, and it came out negative. So this was another piece of manufactured evidence besides Myrtle Poirbert, the witnesses, and stuff like this. So then their case fell apart, and then in 1985, when the federal, Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, Judge Haney asked the prosecutors, just what was Mr. Peltier convicted of, because we cannot find no evidence of first-degree murder in the record. The prosecutor, Lynn Crooks, stated that the government doesn't know who killed the agents, nor does he know what participation Leonard Peltier may have had in it. So in 1992, I filed an appeal again asking, what was I in prison for if the government doesn't know what I'm in here for? So they changed it to aiding and abetting, which is illegal because I was never indicted for it. I was never prosecuted for it. And it takes a whole different defense in your trial. So I don't know what the hell I'm in here for.
What is your
response? So far, it ain't looking very good, I'll tell you that much.
What is your response to the FBI that campaigns against your release?
Oh, they're full of crap. You know, they're the ones that should be investigated for all the murders they committed on Pine Ridge. They supported those killings. They financed it. They gave intelligence and armor-piercing ammunition and sophisticated weaponry. This was all stated by Dwayne Brewer, who was one of the leaders of the goon squads on the reservation. So, I mean, they're the ones that should be investigated, which, by the way, so I might add now, some of the Indians that won state senators in South Dakota are now calling for an investigation on that. They are going to put it together. And the son of Tim Johnson, who is an attorney, one in the attorney general's office in South Dakota, Tim Johnson's congressman over there, his son is going to lead that investigation.
And what's the significance of that?
Well, you can put the murderers in jail. I mean, that's what I look at it. I mean,
for people who don't know about your case, especially young people, how would you like to be described? How would you, Leonard Peltier, like to be known to them?
Well, just somebody that stood up for his people's rights and who tried to stop the Termination Act and all the other crimes committed against my people. That's the only reason I'm here.
Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Spoke with Peltier at a press conference in 2012.
The company spoke to the high command. We need the deeds to the Indian land to dig for oil and uranium ore. Maybe have to start a little Indian war. The orders came from away on high, and if there was a job for the FBI, it won't be hard, all we'll have to do is...
From the Black Hills of the Lakota Nation, Chase Iron Eyes shares deep historical insights and issues a powerful challenge for our survival. Chase Iron Eyes is an attorney with the Lakota People's Law Project. He is currently running for the presidency of the Oglala Sioux Tribe, which is on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota.
Kola Iuha Ichichab Madakuyapi Chante Washte Napechus Bapelo. My name is Chase Iron Eyes. It's very important that we talk about these issues that directly relate to Indigenous Peoples Day.
Oh, the lies that were spoken, oh, the blood we have spilled, oh, the treaties that were broken, oh, the leaders you have still.
Going from the practice of lying to ourselves and telling ourselves that Christopher Columbus is a man to be celebrated or that he discovered anything, when Christopher Columbus is a child rapist and a sex trafficker, and he had stumbled upon lands that we had civilized eons before any Europeans, Christian, or any Abrahamic people or non-Abrahamic people stumbled onto our homelands. And so, as Indigenous nations, as Indigenous peoples, we've always welcomed foreigners, European Americans. When they first got here, if it wasn't for us, they would have died in our homeland because it was completely new to them. And they were essentially migrants or immigrants. And unlike President Trump, who is also an alleged rapist, we didn't lock those migrants, his people, in cages when they got to our borders, nor did we ask them for their papers. In fact, we delivered them from their ignorance in a new land. And it's because of our charity, because our beneficence, that they are here today.
For the tribes you terminated, for the myth you keep alive, for the land you confiscated, for our freedom you deprive.
We didn't choose to be inside this dynamic of oppressed and oppressor, colonizer and colonized. But if I am truthful with myself as a European American, then I've got to recognize that I don't have a God-given right to be in my country. My only right to be here in this hemisphere only extends so far as the indigenous civilizers, the original nations, have given me permission through their treaties. So on Indigenous Peoples Day, we need the entire country to take notice and recognize that Indigenous peoples, again, are standing in the power of our truths and reaching out our hand. We have a sage branch. We have an olive branch reaching out to the American people once again and saying, look it, what your grandmothers and grandfathers have brought here and sold to the world, like snake oil salesmen have sold to the world as civilization, has brought us to the precipice of an extinction level event. And Trump and his brown shirts 2.0 and the fascism that is on our doorstep is calling us to be truthful with each other and reconcile where we can.
For the truth that you pollute, for the life that you have cost, for the good you prostitute, and for all that we have lost.
We have to re-spiritualize our lives. This is why we are at No Dapple and Standing Rock in the scores of thousands showing up ready to give our lives. This is why we are fighting the Keystone XL pipeline and the man camps, the rapists, criminals, and thugs that they bring into our daughters' homelands. This is why we are shutting down our borders to tourists and visitors who may have COVID. In fact, during Trump's visit July 3rd, he taunted and flaunted that hundreds of thousands of his supporters would be coming to the 80th anniversary Sturgis rally. And they did come here and they exposed this entire state to COVID-19. In fact, they caused record numbers to spread like a bunch of outbreak monkeys who were prodded on by this state's governor, Governor Kristi Noem. As you know, she threatened to invade our borders or to sue us in a court of law because we want to protect ourselves from another Eurasian plague. And because of that threat, I got to witness sovereignty in action. So part of what's happening here in Lakota country is we are fighting with our lives to have land back in Indigenous hands, in and around the sacred Black Hills.
Buster died for your sin. Buster died for your sin. Now a new day must begin.
We still hold sacred those covenants that we have with Mother Earth, with Mother Nature, with the sacred universe. And this is why we conduct ourselves in ceremonial protocols or rituals on a seasonal basis. And those ceremonies have been happening since time immemorial. So now we are in a position where those colonial forces, those financial extractive corporate colonial forces that colonized Europe before Europeans landed on our shores, they have been unable to conquer us. They have been unable to extinguish our collective fires, not just the Lakota people, the Haudenosaunee people, the Salagi people, the coastal, the West Coast civilizations, the Cedar people, the Salmon people, the Corn people down in the Southwest. All this land knows us and loves us. And on Indigenous Peoples Day, we need to spread our message far and wide that we are here once again to receive you in peace.
From the Indian reservation to the governmental school, well, they're going to educate me
to the white man's golden room.
We're like the canary in the coal mine, brother. Everything that you see us doing is coming for you next. Everybody who was brutalized, maimed, the people who lost their eye, the people who had their arms blown up on Standing Rock, they are now part of a group of people, a class of people who are on the receiving end of unjustified corporate brutality. This is corporate-sponsored state violence, and we're all experiencing it together. So whatever we're doing, we need you to take note and join us. We can't do this alone. We need to build bridges, not walls, in this time. And we have to recognize that we need each other in order to survive. This is life or death for our country and our people right now. We have to meet our destiny halfway and awaken ourselves. Do what you can where you are to seek that spiritual liberation. Happy Indigenous Peoples Day.
And there are drums beyond the mountain, Indian drums that you can hear. There are drums beyond the mountain, and they're getting mighty near.
Appreciations to attorney and activist Chase Arnaiz for the gift of his wisdom, inspiration, and courage. Music by Floyd Westerman from Custer Died for Your Sins and Drums. This presentation was produced for COVID, Race, and Democracy by Ken Yale and Polina Vasiliev.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
As faith keeper of the Turtle Clan of the Onondaga Nation, Chief Orrin Lyons has devoted his life to maintaining the traditions, values, and history of the Turtle Clan and uphold the great law of peace of the Haudenosaunee, which served as the model for this Constitution of the United States. Here, Chief Lyons talks about the doctrine of discovery and its enduring impact on Indigenous people.
the way things are going today around the world, gather support for indigenous peoples, gather support for Mother Earth in trying to ensure the mandate that we have, which is for the future generations. Very important that we recognize extreme necessity today to think very clearly about that responsibility. We ourselves, as individuals, have to educate ourselves better. We have to exchange, got to talk more, and have to be more assertive about the direction of your lives. And the issue of seven generations is serious, really serious now. That ice is melting. The Natural World Authority is going to take over. And if you want to talk about economies going down, that'll go down. That's only going to accelerate. So we have to be proactive these days. Be your own leader. Real good advice. Make up your own mind. You know, how did it get this way? How did come treaties aren't honored? How come Indians lost all the land? How come Indians were moved? How come all of that history? And it comes down to the doctrine of discovery. Some years back, around 1991, I think this kid comes walking into the elders' meeting out there in Tulalip, and he's got papers under his arms. He's a young man, Delaware, he says, I'm a Delaware, and I have some information. I think somebody's got to know. And he talked about the doctrine of discovery, and we didn't know that. And he explained how way back the Pope issued a papal bull edict declaring that indigenous people did not have a right of title to land. He said if there were no Christian nations, then the land was open for Christian occupation. And he said if there were no Christian people in this land, then they did not have a right of title to land. They had only the right of occupancy. 1493, 1 year later, took over the whole Western Hemisphere. One big statement. All of a sudden, we were gone and they were there. Of course, we didn't know that. But that was the underlying move. That's how we lost land. In 1823, a very famous case called Johnson versus McIntosh, the Supreme Court. A couple of white guys arguing over Indian land. Judge Marshall says to them, well, he says, you got this all wrong, you know, Indians don't have title. And so he went back to 1796 and he said the Cabots from England were given the right and title to come and occupy land. The King of England said, well, if the Pope can do it, so can I. And he did. Well, you know, they split away from the Roman Catholic Church. That was made their own Bible, King James Version. And we were caught in the middle. We were caught in this event. And he said that this is how we've taken land. And we're not going to change now. So 1823, the doctrine of discovery goes into U.S. Supreme Court law. 1955, Tihatan Indians were made a land claim, and they lost. And in the Supreme Court statement, this you could look it up, Tihatan versus U.S., T-E-E-H-I-T-T-O-N, Tihatan versus U.S., 1955. And read the racist language in there. And said, not only do we not have to compensate you for your land, you know, we don't have to, he said, not only can we take your land, we don't have to compensate you, because you don't have title. That's 1955, U.S. Supreme Court. Well, gets on Indians in Canada. They brought a land claim, British Columbia. 1991, they lost on guess what? The doctrine of discovery. The law of nations. Canada, Canadian law, Australia, they're battling the doctrine of discovery. It's around the world. Little town of Sherrill over here brought this claim against the Oneidas. Said, you got to pay taxes, and the Oneidas said, it's our land. Well, we won that land. Supreme Court says so. Well, Went all the way to Supreme Court. Supreme Court turned right around and says, no, you have to pay taxes. So it's a very, very uneven, unjust system that is prevailing today in this country. Very uneven for American Indians. It's unfair, unjust, but it's real, knowing full well there was a penalty. That's what goes on in this world. Much of you don't know that because you're not involved. Your identity was settled in 1776. And, you know, when the Blackfeet Indians brought this case against the Department of Interior, demanded to know where did, what, $8 billion disappear to? Can you account for the $8 billion that you guys were entrusted to look after? The justice, the judge that was adjudicating the case, was incensed by the attitude of the Department of Interior. And they were, I mean, the heads of the Department of Interior were charged. And eventually, they removed the judge. And they said, you're too biased. So who knows the injustice, unless the American people speak up. There's an old story, you know, about the Nazi Germany, when they said, first they came for the Jews, finally they come for you. I don't have any advice or answers to that. I just alert you to the fact that that's what's occurring now. It's not good for a democratic nation. And how in the world can a leader of this country go around the world to talk about democracy when he can't give it back to the original people of this land? You have to get a little reality here. If we're going to survive, if we're going to have to do this collectively. Democracy doesn't come at the end of a gun.
That was Chief Orrin Lyons on how the doctrine of discovery came about in 1493 after Columbus's return to Europe and how it was inserted into U.S. policy. The International Indian Treaty Council is one of the most powerful voices in the world for indigenous peoples. Founded on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in 1974, its executive director is Andrea Carmen, a member of the Yaqui Nation in southern Arizona and Sonora, Mexico. Next up, she shares her deep and moving insights for Indigenous Peoples Day with Pacificus Ken Yale.
My name is Andrea Carmen. I'm the executive director since 1992 of the International Indian Treaty Council, which is an international representative organization with affiliates who are indigenous nations, tribes, organizations, and communities, all the way from Alaska, throughout Canada, United States, Mexico, all the way down to Argentina, South America, and then out to the Pacific Islands and the Caribbean. We've been working at the United Nations since 1977, not just in the human rights arena, but also we're on the UN Committee on Food Security. We have a formal role with the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. We work on biodiversity, the environmental conventions, and you know everything that affects our peoples, we really need to be at the table.
I'm wondering about the significance of Indigenous Peoples Day to Indigenous communities. Is it generally meaningful, or is it more like just a token effort by local and state governments who aren't really addressing Indigenous needs or rights or demands?
I guess you could say it's some of each. You know, for us, truth and history is extremely important, not just for our own children that were raised with the myth of Columbus discovering America or raised with the myth of the pilgrims sitting down with the indigenous peoples in a, you know, friendly dinner for now what's called Thanksgiving. You know, the history of indigenous peoples in this hemisphere since October 12, 1492, and in this country is brushed under the rug. These are issues that modern day Americans, you could say, don't really want to talk about, except for as the Black Lives Matter movement pointed out, the legacies of these historical injustices, and in our case, genocide, you know, continue to this day. Our sacred sites continue to be desecrated from development. Our languages are among the most threatened in the world, and that's been identified by the United Nations because of the legacies of boarding schools and forced assimilation. You know, these things continue to affect us. So it's important for people to look at that, because truth in history is important, not just for our children, but everybody's children, that we face what happened.
What do you see as the very biggest issues facing Indigenous peoples in the U.S. and around the world?
The most critical issue that I feel is affecting our survival on the ground is climate change, the climate crisis. It affects biodiversity, it affects our foods, it affects our ceremonies. And then on top of that, now we have the effect of COVID-19, and they're very closely related, because a lot of the vulnerabilities of Indigenous peoples is related to the poor condition in many places of our health and lack of access to health services. But a lot of the health issues we're facing in the United States, like obesity and diabetes and asthma, those kinds of things are directly related to the ongoing environmental contamination and environmental violence on our lands. So all of these issues come together, you know, as well as lack of access to our traditional foods and seeds and methods, the ongoing issues of violation of our land rights, our treaty rights, our cultural rights, protection of our sacred sites. But I would say the most critical crisis situations we're facing are the combined impacts and interrelated impacts of the climate crisis and the crisis caused by COVID-19 right now in our communities, where a lot of our elders and traditional knowledge holders are also, you know, passing away before their time because of COVID. So, you know, it relates directly to our ability to be resilient and to protect our traditional knowledge and ways of life.
Let me ask you briefly to sketch some of the key ways that Indigenous peoples are successfully fighting for self-determination and sovereign rights in the midst of all these assaults.
One thing we're seeing in many countries, including the United States and Canada, is the governments have used the COVID pandemic as an excuse to impose development, even, you know, fossil fuel development that, you know, is the main cause of climate change, and to also pass legislation that makes it illegal to protest pipelines and those kinds of things, you know, mining. But the resistance of Indigenous peoples, you know, has continued. In Latin America, just last year, there was at least 30 documented killings of Indigenous human rights defenders. And this is a big topic of consideration internationally, is the issue of human, environmental, and treaty rights defenders and the repression against them. So we can shine that international spotlight on a lot of these violations, and at least they won't go unknown and unchallenged.
What are some lessons that Indigenous cultures can teach the world in the midst of this global pandemic, climate disruption, rising fascist white supremacist violence?
Indigenous people's main message is the ability and the priority to live in harmony with the natural world and to have mutual respect and peaceful relations with all peoples. As long as our rights are recognized and upheld, we can also do that for others. The impact of the pandemic, of climate change, of all of this imposed development, disregarding the rights and the free, prior, informed consent of Indigenous peoples on their homelands, desecration of our sacred sites, all is based on a lack of respect and respectful relations with the natural world and within the human family. And that's a lesson that Indigenous peoples can take internationally as well as, you know, at the local level, that we can be the examples of how to live in a respectful way. with all of creation and the created world.
That was Andrea Carmen, Executive Director of the International Indian Treaty Council, in conversation with Pacifica's Ken Yale. Visit the International Indian Treaty Council website to subscribe to their e-news and participate in webinars, or watch their video for schools called God, Greed, and Genocide. This is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Jacqueline Batiste.
We don't have to hide anymore, 'cause now's the time. With forgiveness as my bow and my prayers as my arrows, pull them back and let go. I watch them fly like sparrows, have hope. Yeah, have hope.
With compassion
as my shield and faith, down to my marrow, I will walk the pollen path, even when it gets narrow. Yeah, yeah, I resurrect. Yes, you can bet that we seen the single mama raising children on the res. We seen domestic violence tear apart what we have left. We seen the alcohol take it all and leave us dead. We seen the children take their lives when they can't take the dread anymore.
It's a war.
Can't take the dread anymore.
It's a war.
No, we can't take the dread anymore.
It's a war.
No, we can't take the dread anymore.
It's a war. Yeah.
It's a war, but we've seen it all before. And now we know we can change it, 'cause that's why we were born. We know we are the ones that we have been waiting for. We are the ones Grandma has been praying for.
So rise up, all you warriors of love, all you answers to the prayers of our ancestors from above.
I can feel it in my heart. Can you feel it in your blood? I can hear the seventh fire calling us to wake up.
Wake up.
Pueblo hermoso, levántense, es nuestro tiempo. No tienes que esconderte más. Ahora es nuestro tiempo.
Mujer indígena, tú eres tan sagrada. Traigas medicina de tu suelo todavía.
And now we'll hear from Edna Sandoval and Karina Reyes, host of Con Las Comadres, a trans-territorial feminist media project that centers the voices and art of femmes and non-binary Black, Indigenous, and other people of color.
The story you'll hear now will be in two languages, Spanish and English. If you don't understand it right away, just be patient. We promise to tell you what it's all about.
Pueblos, barrios, periferias, colonias y poblas somos varias, las que ya no se conforman, no callamos. Escribimos ahora nuestra historia exigiendo el derecho de existir en la memoria. Pueblos, barrios, periferias, colonias y poblas somos varios, los que ya no se conforman, no callamos. Escribimos ahora nuestra historia exigiendo el derecho de existir en la memoria.
Acabas de escuchar a la rapera indígena oaxaqueña Mare Advertencia Lírica con su canción Escribiendo Historia.
You've just heard indigenous rapper from Oaxaca, Mexico, Mare Advertencia Lírica. The song is titled Escribiendo Historia, or Writing History.
Somos con las comadres. Mi nombre es Edna Sandoval.
And I'm Karina Reyes. We are honored today to be part of Pacifica Radio's Indigenous Peoples Day segment. As a trans-territorial feminist media project, we present the knowledge, voices, and art of femmes and non-binary folks of color in our communities and across the world. It is our hope that these conversations challenge dominant narratives in our work to deconstruct the oppressive systems that for centuries have erased and oppressed our communities of color. And through this work, present alternatives and solutions that will help us on our way to constructing a future in which we are all truly liberated.
And today we are presenting Rosa Chavez. Rosa es una poeta, artista del territorio de Abyayala en Guatemala. Y así como reconocemos que Abyayala es el territorio que se conoce como las Américas, queremos reconocer que también el día de hoy estamos en territorio Tonga, también conocido como Los Ángeles. El trabajo de Rosa Chavez es un trabajo que también desconstruye y que también reta las narrativas que existen sobre las mujeres mayas en Guatemala y en el resto de Centroamérica y México.
Rosa Chavez is an indigenous Maya Quiche Cachiquel poet.
Es importante que el trabajo de Rosa se lea no como un trabajo exclusivamente político, pero también como un trabajo de sanación, como un trabajo de comadrazgo, y como un trabajo de crecimiento personal y de feminismo. Aquí va Rosa.
Creo que me he ido encontrando con la palabra y el poder de la palabra con el transcurso del tiempo. Lo asumo como una función.
Rosa Chavez tells us about how she came to write poetry in the post-war period in Guatemala after the peace agreement was signed in 1996 and artistic expression flourished. She talks about her experience as a migrant from her native community to the capital and coming to understand the power of the spoken word in its poetic form to reshape and re-signify the reality around her.
Hacia la llamada paz, entonces esta generación de poetas de la posguerra en Guatemala, la guerra que dura 36 años y se firma la paz en el año 96, entonces había una efervescencia de las manifestaciones artísticas en la ciudad. Estoy hablando acá, bueno, fui una mujer, una joven que migró de mi comunidad hacia la ciudad para estudiar, entonces también en estas búsquedas que tenemos de expresarnos, me encuentro con mi propia voz, mi amor por la palabra y por la poesía, pero también es muy importante no solo en la poesía, sino reconocer el valor de la palabra y el poder de la palabra, el poder nombrar y el poder crear realidad o resignificar es parte de lo que yo siento cuando escribo o cuando comparto.
Writing in Spanish, she struggles with the colonizer's language imposed on her indigenous peoples, but feels that it's her right to use Spanish to bring back the erased stories of her people, especially women's stories.
Mi idioma materno, yo soy una mujer maya, quiché cachiquel, quiché por parte paterna, cachiquel de parte materna. Los procesos de migración y ante el racismo y la discriminación que se vivían y se siguen viviendo, mi familia decide no trasladarnos el idioma. Entonces ha sido para mí un proceso de recuperación también mi idioma. No ha sido fácil. Yo escribo la mayoría de los textos en español, pero bueno, también en realidad siento que es un derecho para mí utilizar el idioma español, este idioma que fue impuesto para los pueblos, pero que también entonces hacemos nuestro, y si hemos sido despojadas y despojados de nuestro idioma, poder utilizar este mismo idioma para reivindicar nuestras historias, nuestras luchas, nuestra palabra como mujeres originarias.
She reflects on how indigenous Mayan women live under different standards that are imposed on them by the dominant culture and carry the expectations of being the standard bearers of their culture.
Pero también veo cómo en el presente hay muchas otras jóvenes mayas que están escribiendo en maya, en español. Entonces yo creo que está bien ir abriendo brecha para otras que vienen y que también las mujeres mayas somos diversas. De pronto también me parece racista el esperar que seamos de alguna manera determinada o que cumplamos ciertos parámetros de lo que debe ser una mujer maya, porque somos mujeres diversas y cambiantes. Hay mucha imposición sobre lo que deberíamos ser o sobre ser de pronto los estandartes de la cultura, pero creo en la autonomía, creo que también tenemos historias muy diversas y en esas historias vamos reconstruyendo nuestra identidad.
Rosa Chavez also speaks about finding a true network of solidarity and sorority with other Mayan women, which has been essential in a collective journey towards healing and the path to decolonizing knowledge.
Entonces las redes afectivas de solidaridad, de sororidad, son fundamentales para la sobrevivencia. Tengo mi grupo de comadres que han sido un soporte emocional, intelectual, y con el tiempo se van afianzando estos lazos. Yo creo que son muy importantes para, estamos hablando de las mujeres, entonces para nosotras, las mujeres, crear comunidad. Una comunidad de cuidado, pero también una comunidad de denuncia y una comunidad de soporte, de saber que si estamos en una dificultad o en una situación, que van a estar ahí, que vamos a creernos mutuamente, que nos vamos a acompañar, y esto ha sido para mí fundamental.
Rosa Chavez is an indigenous Maya Quiche Cachiquel poet, speaking to the collective Con Las Comadres.
Yancy Balderas is an activist whose life changed in 2004 when her boyfriend from middle and high school was arrested for capital murder in Texas. Juan Balderas was held for over 8 years before his death row case was even tried. Yancy came to the United States from El Salvador at 6 years old and is the first in her family to finish high school and is now studying to become an attorney.
Hello, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for organizing this event. The death penalty affects us, affects me every day. We've come to see personally how this court in Harris County works. It continues to be run the same way. Things like allowing the nephew of the prosecutor on his jury should never be allowed. We got millions of people in Houston. Why allow the nephew of the prosecutor to be part of his jury? Why not accept when the jury comes back with the hung after 2.5 days? Why not accept? Maybe if we were cops, if this was a cop case, they would have accepted that hung jury. But for us, they made the jury continue deliberating after 2.5 days. After being hung, after sending a note that they had exceeded their attempts to come to a conclusion in his innocence. And then we are giving Jerome Gottnich, according to the judge in this case, he's a pioneer of capital murder defense attorneys, a pioneer. Juan waited 8.5 years. Juan never had an investigation. Trial was set 4 years in. Juan had never met his attorney. We met the second chair until trial 8.5 years later. We never met an investigator. They don't care. And us, sometimes we're ignorant to the laws and the process, and we trust that the process is going to be right and it's going to be just. But that's not true. And I've seen it not only Juan's case, and so many other cases coming out of Harris County. Here we are sitting on death row 6.5 years. And still demanding to be given all the evidence. We want all the evidence turned over. We got some evidence turned over in 2018 when it should have been turned over at trial, not years after sitting on death row. Yes, those information should be looked at, but no, the courts don't want to even give us the chance to present the evidence we have. They want to rubber stamp word by word and get what the prosecutors present. It's broken in Texas. It can't be fixed. We should abolish the death penalty because who's sitting on death row? It's poor people that can't afford representation, to have Jerome Gottnich as a representation. The jury came back with 13 questions. We did not have one attorney present at court. to answer those questions. 300 cases that year. How is that proper representation? And I know we got it tough here in Texas, but we'll continue with the death penalty abolition movement and with the coalition against the death penalty and with everyone that wants to join us in Austin. We'll continue fighting to abolish the death penalty.
That was Yancy Balderez. She is an advocate for people serving time on death row. Her energy and courage is an inspiration to us all. She spoke at the 21st Annual March to Abolish the Death Penalty virtual edition held on October 10, 2020. She and Juan married before they left Harris County Jail in Houston for death row.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
And finally, Dr. Eddie S. Glaude, Jr., a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University.
The best way to talk about the lie is to quote a passage on page 9. It's from Jimmy's 1964 essay, The White Problem. He wrote it in for Robert A. Goodwin's edited volume, 100 Years of Emancipation. And he reads, "The people who settled the country had a fatal flaw. They could recognize a man when they saw one. They knew he wasn't anything else but a man. But since they were Christian, and since they had already decided that they came here to establish a free country, the only way to justify the role this chattel was playing in one's life was to say that he was not a man. Or if he wasn't, then no crime had been committed. That lie is the basis of our present trouble." And so what Baldwin is saying here at the heart of it is that there have been lies told about Black people's capacities, about our character, about our passions, all to justify, right, this system of exploitation, this system, this cruel, barbaric system of slavery that is at the heart of the founding of the modern world, at the heart of the founding of the country. And so not only do you have lies about Black people, you have lies about what white Americans have done to Black people, and then you have the lie that this is the key point. There's a way in which the lie works that it malforms, I use that verb on purpose, it malforms any effort to expose the country to the reality of what it has done. Anything that comes to reveal the truth of what the nation has done, what it has done to the native peoples, what it has done in Haiti and Cuba and the Philippines, what it has done in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, anything that actually reveals that America is not the shining city on the hill or the Redeemer Nation, or the example of democracy achieved. Anything that attempts to reveal that reality is immediately dismissed as heresy, delegitimized from the beginning. And that lie is the architecture within which the value gap breathes. And the value gap is this fundamental belief that white people matter more than others. It's at the heart of our social arrangements, our political arrangements, our economic arrangements. It's a valuation of Black folk and a valuation of white folk that lead to the distribution of advantage and disadvantage that distorts the character of these folk who hold it, so they can't even become the kinds of people their conception of democracy requires.
Dr. Eddie S. Glaude, Jr., a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University. That concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates who contributed to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by Akua Holt and myself, Jacqueline Batiste. The show's executive producers are Akua Holt, Steve Zelzer, and Paulina Vasiliev. Verna Avery Brown is our executive consultant. You can find this and all previous episodes on our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.